Welcome back. Remember where we were? We said that we can take a field such as the electromagnetic or the Klein-Gordon field and decompose it into harmonic oscillators. Therefore, we focused on individual harmonic oscillators in the expectation that eventually we would put a lot of them together into a quantum field eventually. So we started with a single harmonic oscillator, and we said there are two ways to excite them, to excite an individual harmonic oscillator. One is through external driving, and we said that this will have applications in particle physics where different species of particles crash into another. And then there's also parametric driving, where some parameter of the equation of motion is being modified in a time-dependent way, even though there is no driving force externally that has been added. And we got about halfway through, a bit more than halfway through, the treatment of the individual quantum harmonic oscillators, oscillator that is externally driven. That's the simplest case one can do. And we will today complete that case, the externally driven quantum harmonic oscillator. And I should be precise, it's the classically externally driven quantum harmonic oscillator. Because this J, the force that shakes our harmonic oscillator externally, didn't have a hat on it. It was number valued. In the case of the electromagnetic field or other fields, this corresponds to the situation where the electromagnetic field is treated quantumly. Its harmonic oscillators are quantum harmonic oscillators, but the driving forces are classically treated charges and currents. So today, we will complete that study of the classically externally driven harmonic oscillator, and we will arrive at the notion of Bogoliubov transformation. All of this is meant to be an exercise to get us used to the Heisenberg picture here. Because remember that when you have a harmonic oscillator, usually we would treat it in the Schrödinger picture, and then it's the state that evolves. But in the Heisenberg picture, it's these operators that are time dependent. And in particular, this also means that the operators A and A dagger are time dependent. And it also means that the Hamiltonian is time dependent. It's time dependent actually because we have a driving force. Now, by the way, I wanted to make a comment here about the time dependence of operators. Imagine Q hat is some observable in a quantum theory, be it quantum mechanics or quantum field theory. And let's say we work in the Heisenberg picture, so therefore it is time dependent. We have a Q of T naught, and we have a Q of T. Now, since the operator is time dependent, its spectrum and eigenvectors might depend on time. If they don't, it remains the same operator. I just made a mistake, though. The spectrum cannot change. It's only the eigenvectors. Let me show you why that is. When you have q hat of t naught, and let's say that there is a vector in the Hilbert space, which is an eigenvector of this operator with eigenvalue qn, right? Then we could ask, does this operator that evolved from that one, does it also have qn as an eigenvalue? And the answer is yes. You see, what is this? This is actually u hat dagger of t, q hat of t naught, u hat of t, right? And now let's say we act with this operator. So what we can do is we can multiply here. So we take the u hat dagger of t and q hat of t naught and u hat of t. And then the question is, can you think of an eigenvector of this operator? What might be an eigenvector of this operator? and claiming that you had dagger of t acting on qn. Let's call this q tilde n is an eigenvector. And why is that? Well, because these guys go away. The q hat acts on this by multiplying with qn. So therefore, this is qn. And then the same thing again. It's u hat dagger of t acting on qn. So what we just showed is that this, which is q hat of t acting on q tilde n, is equal to qn q tilde n, right? Because that's this thing again. So what we see here is that in the Heisenberg pictures, the operators change. They are time dependent. The spectrum, though, weirdly, or maybe well, it's natural, as we now see, is always preserved. And that's because of the unitarity of the time evolution. There's one caveat, though. What if your observable evolves not only by the Heisenberg equation of motion, but you also built in by hand an extra time dependence? For example, in quantum mechanics, you could have that you have, let's say, the q hat operator, and you have the p hat operator. And then you define a new operator f hat of t to be the cosine of omega tilde t q hat plus e to the power of lambda t p hat. And these guys may also be time dependent. It's the Heisenberg picture, after all. And then what we have is that f hat of t depends in two ways on time. One is because q hat depends on time, p hat depends on time. But also, we manually put some extra time dependence in there. If you do this, then there is no guarantee that the spectrum of the operator here is preserved. Now, normally, that doesn't come up with observables, but it does come up with the Hamiltonian, because the Hamiltonian often has parameters in it that change, in particular when we do quantum field theory on curved spacetime, because there our Hamiltonians will contain the metric. And as the metric changes, the Hamiltonian changes, its spectrum changes. So therefore, when you have parametric changes of the Hamiltonian, it can change not only its eigenvectors, but also its eigenvalues. But as a general rule, if you work with ordinary observables, primary observables, whose time dependence is only because of the Heisenberg picture, not because you've just arbitrarily defined some extra time dependence in them, for these observables, the eigenvectors can change, but the spectrum never. It also means that, for example, the spectrum of the position operator, momentum operator, angular momentum operator, spin operators, really all observables, is always preserved in time. OK, so we work in the Heisenberg picture. And we are considering the externally classically driven harmonic oscillator. And let us now look at the energy before and after and the behavior of the Hamiltonian. Remember that the Hamiltonian can be written at all times in this form. It's omega times a dagger a of t plus 1/2. This is the famous ground state energy, 1/2 h bar omega. And then here we have a q hat times j of t. That's just the elongation or the position of the harmonic oscillator. And j of t doesn't have a hat. It's just a classical driving force. Then we said, let us consider three phases. The first phase is before the force kicked in. The second phase is while it is acting. And the third phase is after the force kicked in. So before the time 0, before the force started, we write the Hamiltonian as omega times a dagger in, a in plus 1/2. This is just, a in is just a name for the a hat of t before the force kicked in, because there they don't, this product actually doesn't change. Then while the force is acting, we have the complicated expression. Doesn't matter. We usually focus on the before and the after. And then after the force is done acting, the Hamiltonian takes again this form, same form. It's a free quantum harmonic oscillator after all, so the Hamiltonian takes the same form. But because it's the Heisenberg picture, the state is still the same. The operators have changed. And that means that this A out, is not the same as the A in. That's where the entirety of the evolution is now buried. It's no longer in the state. The state has not changed at all. And you see there's an advantage here with the Heisenberg picture, because this is now a solution. It's state independent, right? It's the solution of the dynamical problem for all states. In the Schrödinger picture, we would have chosen an initial state, such as a Gaussian or whatever, and then evolved it forward in time. Would have been really complicated. Here we said Heisenberg picture, and then we get how the A operator depends on time, and from that we can calculate everything, because we can express all observables in terms of the A and the A dagger, because we can express the Q and the P in terms of A and A dagger. So after some work, we found out how the A out is related to the A in. Namely, we found that A out is A in plus J naught, and J naught is a complex number. It's this complex number obtained by this integral here. And we notice that this integral is the calculation, amounts to the calculation of the inner product of a plane wave, this exponential here, with the driving force, the time-dependent driving force. And we notice that if this integral were to run from minus infinity to plus infinity, so if the force never ended, or in fact, if the force does have a starting point and does have an ending point, then we can write this thing as from minus infinity to plus infinity, then what we have is that this is actually the Fourier transform component of J at the frequency omega. And so J naught is really the Fourier component of the driving force at the frequency omega. And what that means is that, strictly speaking, of all of what the driving force does, the only thing that enters into the solution of the quantum mechanical problem is how much of the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator, namely omega, was in a driving force. It means, for example, too, that if we happen to drive the harmonic oscillator in a very special way, such that we made sure that the Fourier transform of that driving force doesn't contain the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator, then after the driving is over, the harmonic oscillator is back to its ground state. It got excited while the action of the force was going on, but when the force ended, bang, the harmonic oscillator is back to its ground state, because the J naught is zero then. See, it literally means if the Fourier component of J at the frequency of the harmonic oscillator is vanishing, then J naught is vanishing, and A out is A in, and so the ground state of the harmonic oscillator at the beginning is the same as the ground state of the harmonic oscillator at the end, because A in is A out. And the eigenstate to A in with eigenvalue 0 is the ground state at the beginning, and the eigenvector 0 out to the out A operator is the ground state of the harmonic oscillator late. Okay, but in general, there is going to be a Fourier component. Now, for early times, before the force kicked in, we had that the Hamiltonian was this. We already had that here. The Hamiltonian was this, and it was constant because nothing was going on, right? It was just constant here. And we can construct at this early time an eigenbasis of the early Hamiltonian. And we called these basis vectors n in. They're eigenvectors to the operator a dagger a, but they're also eigenvectors to the operator omega a dagger a plus 1/2. So these are eigenvectors of the so-called number operator, a dagger in, a in, but they're also eigenvectors of the energy operator, the Hamiltonian. And the energy eigenvalues, you know, of course, are these. Notice that the eigenstates are normalized when you have a prefactor of 1 over square root of n factorial.
And then, of course, you apply the A dagger in operator n times on the ground state. So these form a basis of the Hilbert space. And therefore, at all times, not only at early times, at all times, we can expand every vector in Hilbert space in this basis. Now later, after the force is finished with the acting, the Hamiltonian, because of the Heisenberg time evolution, has become a different operator. It still looks like this, but now we have here the A out and the A dagger out instead of the in operators, and these operators have time evolved. So remember, all of the time evolution is in the time evolution of these operators. And we saw up here that it's very simple. The A out operator is simply the A in operator plus this complex number. So then, what are the eigenvectors? N out and the eigenvalues En out of the harmonic oscillator later. Remember, we have these canonical commutation relations, and we have this Hamiltonian, and it looks all the same as previously, before the force acted, just that we replace out by in. And therefore, the same construction goes through again. We find that there's a unique vector that we call 0 out in the Hilbert space, which is eigenvectored to the A out operator, to the eigenvalue 0. And we recognize again that this is the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. And then we can apply an arbitrary integer number of times the A dagger operator on this, the ground state of the harmonic oscillator at the later time. And again, this normalization factor of 1 over square root of n factorial. Notice that, see, I want to draw your attention to the square root here. It comes from the calculation. If you just, you know, multiply this with its Hermitian conjugate, so you take the bra, multiply it with the ket, well, then you get a 1 over n factorial here. And that works out well. But there is later going to be another circumstance where this is important, that the square root, that this is a square root and not just 1 over n factorial. See, in principle, it would be nice if it was without the square root, because then this would be just like an exponentiation, right? It's a dagger to the power n and then divided by n factorial. This looks like a exponential series, but it's not. So then we can prove that the eigenvalues that correspond to these eigenvectors are the En out values, and the En out values are the same as the En in values, namely h bar omega n plus 1/2, which is clear because it was exactly the same construction, right? The Hamiltonian of that form with these commutation relations. So everything must come out the same. Except that the A in and the A out operators are non-trivially related, and therefore the N out vectors are non-trivially related to the N in vectors. And this non-trivial relationship is the so-called Bogoliubov transformation. So let's see how they are related. Remember that we can use this basis or that basis to expand any arbitrary vector in the Hilbert space. This includes those vectors themselves. So this means I should be able to grab one of those and write it as a linear combination of these. I can grab any one of these and write it as a linear combination of those. Now, which one should I pick? If I'm to pick one of these vectors and go through the trouble of calculating how it can be written as a linear superposition of these guys, which one should I pick? A good choice would be to choose the zero in, right? Because if you can expand the zero in as a linear combination of the n outs, then you can also express quite easily the one in, because you get it by just applying an A dagger in on it. And then you can just apply the A dagger in on that linear combination too. It's not that hard because the A dagger in can be written as an A dagger out plus a J naught, or a minus a J naught star. So that's what we're going to do. We are going to express the the zero in as a linear combination of these, and that means then by induction we get all of the in basis vectors in terms of the out basis vectors. So we know, because both are bases, that in particular the zero in vector is some linear combination. We should expect that it will involve infinitely many coefficients, infinitely many terms, some linear combination with coefficients capital lambda n of the out basis vectors. And that is a Bogoliubov transformation. Sometimes we also use the term Bogoliubov transformation to indicate, where is it? Here. This, the A out is A in plus J naught. Expect in the future a much more involved version of this, where we have outs and ins, but lots of them. And then the outs might be a linear combination of the ins, all of them, right? So the one of, because many harmonic oscillators, so they have a label. So we pick one label here, and then this will be a linear combination of all of those, or many of those, and perhaps also of the A in daggers. And then there could also be a J naught with some index and so on. So in general, it can become much more complicated. here we are. Okay, so once we calculate this lambda n, have we made only mathematical progress, or did we actually understand something physically here? What does it mean if we calculate here one of these coefficients? Let's say we calculate capital lambda index 5. Any guesses as to what the physics of that might be, what it could mean experimentally? Yeah?
It's like a scattering matrix. Like, what if you start with this state, what is the probability amplitude that you end up in this state?
Let's talk about colliding particles later. At the moment, it's just one quantum harmonic oscillator. It's not really fields with particles in it.
Excited, I mean that state to the final state.
Yeah, it means that if the state of the system is this, and by the Heisenberg picture method, it stays that state. But at the late times when the force is done acting, it's this basis that tells us how much the harmonic oscillator is excited. And then we can ask, well, is our harmonic oscillator in the fifth excited state, for example? That's that coefficient. That coefficient is then the fifth, is the lambda 5 is the probability amplitude for finding the harmonic oscillator in the fifth excited state. How do we know that? Well, if this is the state of the system, right, because it was prepared in zero in, so it's this state. This it would be the state at all times. And so then after the force has acted, we can ask, okay, this is the state of the system. What's the probability that we find, if we measure it, that it is in the fifth excited state? For that, we have to take this ket vector and multiply it from the left with the out, with the 5 out vector. Right? The 5 out vector is the eigenvector of the number operator at late times. But if we multiply this thing from the left with the bra that is a 5 out, then it will be orthogonal to all vectors except this one. That gives us a 1, and then we are just left with a probability amplitude. Okay, so the meaning of the lambda n, let's say the system state is frozen in a state gamma that we may choose to be 0 in. So this means this is the state of the system at all times, which means this is the state of the system at all times. And then let's say we measure at a late time after the force is done the energy. So we measure the Hamiltonian, which means we are guaranteed to find one of the Hamiltonian's eigenvalues. And then the state collapses into the eigenvector that corresponds to that eigenvalue. So what is the probability amplitude for finding the energy eigenvalue En? Well, as we just said, we take the state of the system, gamma. That's the initial state of the system, gamma, which is this state. And we project it onto n out. And that's the probability amplitude, and the probability is just the modulus squared of that. So if we just do that little calculation, so here is the state of the system. This is the state that we are looking for. The overlap of the two is this, is that, because zero in is that linear combination. And then because of the orthonormality of these outer basis vectors, we have that it's just lambda n. And therefore, the probability for finding the nth excited state at late times is just the modulus squared of that probability amplitude. In quantum field theory, the higher a harmonic oscillator is excited, the more particles there are. Remember, we can choose any momentum to look at. So we choose a momentum 3 vector. And then it has a harmonic oscillator associated with it. And the frequency of that harmonic oscillator is going to be, does somebody know?
K
vector squared plus m squared. That's right. So that's the harmonic oscillator here. And then if the quantum field is with regards to this oscillator in the ground state, then we say, oh, there is no particle with this momentum in the quantum field. If the harmonic oscillator of the quantum field with this momentum k is in the seventh excited state, then we say, oh, there are 7 particles with this momentum in that field. And the whole thing is consistent because every time we add another excitation to the quantum field, it will cost us another h bar omega in energy, because that's the energy gap for this harmonic oscillator, right? And so that means that whenever we have another particle with momentum k vector, then we pay the energy omega for that, right? But that is, so for every k vector, each particle costs us this much. And the reason is that the harmonic oscillator has an equidistantly spaced spectrum. Otherwise, if, for example, the spectrum was to get wider and wider, if the spacing got wider and wider, then it would become energetically more and more expensive to add more particles to that mode, to make more particles of that momentum. But somehow, apparently coincidentally, right? The harmonic oscillator has an equidistant spacing, and that means exactly that every time we add another particle, it costs us this much energy. But this equation is cool because it is just the so-called mass shell condition. It is the dispersion relation for a particle of that momentum, right? So h bar omega. Let's drop the h bar. So what we have is that omega squared is equal to k vector squared plus m squared, right? So this is omega squared minus k vector squared equal to m squared. That's the relativistic relationship between energy and momentum. And you see, that's something that looks coincidental, namely, but it probably isn't, right? So what we see here is that the existence of the particle picture hinges on the fact that the harmonic oscillator has an equidistant spacing. Because otherwise, we couldn't say that we add identical particles. Effectively, their mass would have to change as you add more momentum. But we don't know any theories of that kind. And I find it interesting that we have this seeming coincidence, that we just happen to have equidistant spacing when we need it. You know, Einstein said, oh, inertial mass is gravitational mass? What a coincidence. And then he came up with GR. Maybe one of you looks at this and says, ah, this means, and whatever, something big. right? Let's just keep in mind that there's usually some structure if things just work out very beautifully. Now, let us actually calculate the lambda n. How do we get that? Now, let's do it in exceptionally now, because it's easier to do, let's do it the pure mathy way. The pure mathy way is I give you the solution and then prove it. Right? The physicist's way would be to say, oh, let's derive it. Could do that too, but I think in this case it's easier. I just give you the solution and prove that it's correct. So the solution is that these coefficients here, the expansion coefficients of the in-ground state in terms of the out basis, these coefficients take this form. Remember the J-naught? The J-naught is this Fourier integral. So we have that the lambda n are 1 over square root of n factorial, notice another square root here, times the J-naught to the power n, and then this thing here in front. Let's prove this. Now, what is it we have to prove? We have to prove that this expression is giving us those lambda n. So what we have to prove is that 0 in is actually given by these coefficients, these numbers as the lambda n in terms of the n out basis. So the claim is that this equation is correct, that we can write the 0 in vector as this linear combination of the n out vectors. And if that's true, then we can also calculate what the 1 in and the n in vector is by just applying a dagger ins on the left. But each a dagger in can also be expressed as an a dagger out and the j naught star. OK, so this is what we need to prove. And to prove that, we need to prove two things. First, that it is an eigenvector with the desired eigenvalue, namely 0, because 0 in is eigenvector to a in with eigenvalue 0. So we have to prove that. And the second thing we have to prove is that it's normalized. Now, this part of this expression is n dependent, and that one isn't. And that one is essentially just crucial for normalization. So let's prove that this expression here is 0 in, or at least a number times 0 in, by proving that the a in operator is annihilating this vector. So we want to prove, we want to test that this is true for that expression. And for that, we use that a out is a in plus j naught. Because this means that we can express the a in as a out minus j naught. Which means we can take this a in and express it as a out minus j naught. And we can take this proposition here, namely that 0 in takes that form, which is everything in out quantities. So we have out quantities here, out quantities there. So in practice, this equation becomes a out minus j naught acting on 0 in is 0, eigenvector to eigenvalue 0. And if we substitute this into here, we obtain that equation. So what we need to prove is that this is 0. So what is that then? We have that this is acting on that. Here, this is just number valued. So we can push this a out past these numbers. And also, this we can pull in front of the sum. So we pull this factor right in front of everything. And then this we have act on what's remaining here. So we have the a out minus j naught. And then we have this sum, the j naught to the power n. And then we have a 1 over square root of n here. And this is the expression of n out in terms of 0 out acting with these guys. And remember, we have the square root of n factorial here and the square root of n factorial there. So these guys combine to give us a 1 over n factorial. And then we have this to the power n and that to the power n. So great, it's going to be an exponential. All right, so we have all this long expression here. We carry this forward, that's in front of everything. And then we have the a out minus j naught. And all of this, this series, is just exponentiating j naught times a dagger out. Now, we carry this expression forward. And we carry, see here, what we do is this. We take this expression here. This is an operator times an operator. So it's like A times B. And we can write it as the commutator of A with B plus BA. Right? That's trivial because it's AB minus BA, so then plus BA. So that's what we do. We write this as the commutator here. I mean, here we just carried forward the A out on that and then the minus J naught on this, right? And then this part, we expand like that. So we get a commutator here. And then we get this BA, which is this times that, because this is like the A, this is the B. So this way around. And that expression is just carried forward. At this point, we need to evaluate the commutator of A out with e to the power of j naught a dagger out. Do you know a strategy for how to evaluate that? Let me show you. There's a trick for how to remember that. Remember that a dagger minus a dagger a equal to 1. Now, when you calculate d by dx, this is d by dx, I'm just writing it a shorthand way, times x minus x d by dx is also 1. And what I mean by that is that dx, x, and then f of x minus x dx f of x is equal to f of x. Right? And why is that? Well, it's because here we get two terms. You see, this operator acts actually on all of that. And so what we get here is f of x. That arises when the derivative differentiates the x and leaves that alone. But we also get x, where this was left alone, and then the f of x was differentiated. So dx f of x, right? So this. And then we have, carrying forward, minus x dx f of x. This goes away. And so we are just left with f of x. So what we see is that the d by dx and the x behave the same way that the a and a dagger work. And what that also means is that d by dx of e to the power ax, oh no, I shouldn't use a here. Let's call it wx. What is that going to be? If you apply that to a function, so f of x. Oops. You can show that this is then e w x f of x. Or if we use this now for the I don't know. You've probably done that, right? Have you worked out what this is, like dx x to the power n? You know that this is n x to the power n minus 1. But you can also work out what this is in this sense, where you apply it to a function, right? And then what you find is that this is n x n minus 1. I mean, if you multiply here with an f times an f. So what we have here is very similar. We have the A commutator with e to the power of j naught a dagger. This is just like that. And you can evaluate that by mapping it into the d by dx x. Or you can just go through it term by term. You write down the exponential as a power series, and then you commute the a out through this power of a daggers and so on. And what you get is that this is effectively differentiating our exponential, and you get a j naught down. So now we have two terms with the j naught. You see, this differentiated gives us j naught times the exponential. On the other hand, we also have a minus j naught times the exponential from here. We just carry that forward. It comes from here. So those two terms cancel each other out here. And we're just left with that term here, where we have an a out acting on a 0 out. Never mind what comes after that. The a out cancels the 0 out. And so the whole thing is vanishing. And that's what we wanted to show. We wanted to show that this is true, namely, still moving, that the a in acting on 0 n is 0, where the a in was expressed as a out minus j naught, and the a in was this proposed thing. So we technically, we haven't really shown yet that this is the normalized eigenvector to eigenvalue 0. We just showed it is eigenvector to eigenvalue 0. So in principle, you still need to take this expression, take the Hermitian conjugate of it, and multiply it from the left onto that, and then work out what the series amounts to. And you find that it is normalized. And the reason is that, you know, you get another 1 over square root of n. See, you get a series times a series, but you have orthonormality. And you have a 1 over square root of n times 1 over square root of n gives you 1 over square root of n. With this, you exponentiate it. And in this way, all the terms go away, and you get an identity.
I don't know if we did something illegal, but in this case, would you could you use the fact that you know that a l acting in n l is just square root of n, n minus 1? You could use that, right?
Sorry, what was
like
the claim?
A out applied on n out is square root of n out minus 1.
Right? Oh, I see. Yes. And you want to use that to prove this?
Yeah, because then you just rearrange.
Yeah, you might be able to do that, but we haven't done that. You see, we have not gone through the trouble of calculating these things.
Oh.
Right? I mean, I wanted to use only tools that I showed you before.
But that's my question. I mean, at this point, we know that a out acting on n out kills a quantum.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can also, just to write it up, you can also calculate that a acting on a out, right? Acting on n out is going to be some number times the n minus 1 out, right? And then you can work out what that number is, and you can operate with that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. We know that this number is square root of n, right?
Yeah, but you have to calculate that. Okay. Right, so what we showed, there are many ways to prove the same thing. Okay, so what we showed is how the Bogoliubov transformation works, how we can express the out vectors in terms of the in vectors. Namely, here's the transformation between them. And if you wish, you could check as an exercise that this vector is really normalized with this factor here. Okay, this was the classically externally driven quantum harmonic oscillator, but just one of them. Now let's get back to the quantum fields. Remember that
when we have a lake, then we can use a cork in order to measure how the waves are going up and down. So we can measure locally what the field amplitude is. But we can also use the very same tool to make waves in the first place. We can take this cork and push it up and down. That will make waves. We can also pull on the cork, and that will make waves. And it's the same with quantum fields. You can use particles to probe what the quantum field is doing, but you can also use those particles to create excitations in the field in the first place. So, for example, when you have the electromagnetic field, then you can use a charge, such as an electron, to test what the electric field is, what the magnetic field is, because it acts on the electron. But you can also use the electron to create electromagnetic waves, or just the field. So now remember how the quantum field looked. So if you put all of those harmonic oscillators together, then what we have is that the Hamiltonian is given by the Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian plus the external driving force. So here we have the field amplitudes again, and the J of x and t is like a cork or a charge that is locally driving our field. Now that's the Klein-Gordon field. It's more intuitive for us to work with the electromagnetic field, but the electromagnetic field is just because it's vector valued, or actually tensor valued, it's a bit more tedious to write down. But roughly speaking, the phi hat of x and t can be viewed as a simplified version of the quantum electromagnetic field. And then the j of x and t can be viewed as a simplified version of classical electric charges and classical currents. And current densities, right? So it's current densities or charge densities, J of x and t. So if, for example, we have just one charge that's traveling in the space-time, then how would we describe that in terms of J of x and t? Well, it would be a charge density, J of x and t, that is given by a prefactor q, and then the distribution of the charge in space and time. And that could be a four-dimensional Dirac delta. And here we have a vector x. See, this is J of x and t, I mean the coordinates. And here we have the x tilde of t. So this is a three-dimensional Dirac delta. So this describes a trajectory. So for every point in time, we have a position of our charge, the x tilde, and that's where this charge distribution has a peak. Right? The charge distribution can be evaluated for all x, but it peaks wherever the particle sits at that moment. So that's how you can describe a space and time dependent charge distribution of, in this case, just a single charge. But of course, you could have a much more complicated charge distribution. And that, of course, has to be a classical charge distribution, because a quantum particle that you localize at the point, at the time, would not stay localized. Its momentum uncertainty would be infinite. It would be spreading very fast. But in some approximation, we can write it like this. So then we can, again, look at in and out periods. We could say, let us consider the case where there was no driving force, there was no charge traveling around for early times. So outside the time interval from 0 to capital T, there was no charge going around. And then it suffices to consider, as we did above, the time interval before the charge was going around and the out time interval after the charge was doing its thing. Then we have at early times and at late times, just not at the intermediate times, we have the undriven free quantum field theory. So just the free Klein-Gordon field, whose Hamiltonian is this one. Same as that, but with the force term missing, or the charge term missing. And therefore, what we need to solve at the early time
is the Klein-Gordon equation and the canonical commutation relations. It goes without saying that we also need the hermeticity conditions. As always, we Fourier transform these equations. The main reason being that here we have one harmonic oscillator at every point in space, but these guys are coupled to each other because of the spatial derivative here. After the Fourier transform, the Laplacian becomes a k squared, and that's no longer differentiating. The k squared is only interested in the k itself. It's not differentiating with respect to k. And so therefore, after the Fourier transform, we get a bunch of independent harmonic oscillators. And that's what we have here. So here's the Fourier transform. Remember that after Fourier transform, the field is written as phi subscript k instead of within the bracket k. But it's the same thing. So that's the momentum space quantum field. And what we need to solve is the Klein-Gordon equation with the k squared instead of the Laplacian. And the canonical commutation relations in this form. And remember that the hermeticity condition on the field in the position space becomes this condition after Fourier transform. So how do we solve that then? Well, the procedure for this goes back to Fock, and he proceeded analogously to the single-driven harmonic oscillator that we just covered. So we introduce new variables. In the quantum mechanical case, this was the A operator. That was this cleverly chosen linear combination of the Qs and the Ps. And remember, for later reference, we could choose different prefactors. We would have to pay a price, though, if we chose different prefactors, namely two prices, really. If we are not careful, then the commutation relations between A and A dagger wouldn't be 1 on the right-hand side. It would be something else. But also, we have to also make sure that the two prefactors are such that the Hamiltonian takes the simple form of A dagger A plus 1 half. If we don't choose these factors just right, then the Hamiltonian will have A dagger squared terms in it and A squared terms in it, something that can come up in practical applications. Now, in quantum field theory, we have lots of these harmonic oscillators, one for every momentum, one for every momentum 3 vector. And so we define for each one of these harmonic oscillators an AK operator with just the right combination here of prefactors. But notice that these prefactors are not the same, right? They differ because the K vector changes, so the omega vector changes, so the prefactors change. So numerically, these things are k-dependent. All of these things will matter when space-time is considered dynamical. So in quantum mechanics, in earlier today and in the previous lecture, we had that the A was to obey this equation of motion at early and at late times. Remember, it would also have the fourth term here, but we're only considering the early and the late times. So in quantum mechanics, this is the equation of motion that needs to be solved together with these commutation relations. And in quantum field theory, at early times and at late times. And in quantum field theory, the same deal. This is the equation of motion at early times and at late times. We are implicitly assuming here that the omega is not time dependent. Because remember, so far we are only dealing with external driving forces. We have to be extra careful when we make the omega time dependent. You see, this equation here is special relativistic, but not general relativistic. So we will see how that plays out. Okay, so then we solve the equations of motion at early times and at late times. In quantum mechanics, of the single harmonic oscillator, we found that this is the solution at early times. It's a fixed operator that we call A in times this almost trivial time dependence. And in quantum field theory, same here, these A dagger, these AK operators are a multiple of the A in K operators that are fixed up to this almost trivial phase factor. Once we have A of t, we have A dagger of t, and therefore we have A plus A dagger of t, which is Q, or in quantum field theory, it is the field, and we can also get the canonically conjugate variables. So explicitly in quantum mechanics, we had that from this solution, we can write down the Q hat of t, which looks all very simple, but remember, it encodes everything about the time evolution. In the Schrödinger picture, for example, if we had as the initial state a Gaussian, then over time it would flow apart. And if the Gaussian is, well, it might flow apart and then contract again, but if the Gaussian is not centered, then it would also swing left and right in the harmonic oscillator. And if the initial state is something much more complicated than a Gaussian, then it will both oscillate left and right and up and down, and you know, it will flow apart and then reconcentrate, flow apart, and all of that very complicated stuff. You should really appreciate that in the Heisenberg picture, it's so much easier because we solve it for all states all at once. Anyway, so we have the time dependence of the Q hat operator now. And similarly, in quantum field theory, for every one of the harmonic oscillators, that is to say, for every three momentum k, we have that the amplitude is given by this. Now, in quantum field theory, we don't have to stop with these oscillators. These are the phi hat k. These are the amplitudes of the harmonic oscillators, one each for every point in momentum space. But maybe we are interested in the field in position space. So what we can do is we can take that solution here, the phi k hat of t, and Fourier transform it back into position space. All we need to do is multiply with the Fourier factor, e to the power of I x k, and integrate over k, or sum over k, depending on whether we discretize momentum space through infrared regularization or not. So we get an integral or sum. In this case, I assumed we have not put in an infrared cutoff, so we have a regular Fourier transform. And that means we take this expression here, and we multiply with e to the power ikx, e to the power minus ikx, and we integrate these Fourier factors. And we obtain our field in position space out of that. So that's then the solution for early times, and similarly for late times with the A outs. Now, what are the states in this quantum field theory? We saw that for the quantum harmonic oscillator, there's a ground state, and then there are these excited states. But now we have infinitely many of these harmonic oscillators. In order to interpret what they mean, what the excitation means, we now need to go back to the momentum space representation. In position space, it's very hard to interpret what it means to have five particles here and seven particles there. There is no such thing as a position operator, as we discussed before. And the only safe way, at least so far, that we in this lecture now know, later we will see another way, the only safe way to identify how many particles we have and of what kind is to go back to momentum space. And then we say, in the case of one harmonic oscillator, it has one ground state, the zero-in state at the beginning, and its eigenstate to the A operator, to the A-in operator in the Hilbert space. But in quantum field theory, if we want to prepare a state where all harmonic oscillators are in their ground state, then what that means is that we are looking for a state of the quantum field theory which is to say a state of the system that consists of all of these harmonic oscillators all together at the same time. And this state is then supposed to be the ground state of all the harmonic oscillators. And mathematically, this means that the zero in state of a quantum field theory has to be annihilated by the A in operators of all of its harmonic oscillators. Another way to say that is that the zero in vector, the vacuum vector, the in vacuum vector, is the tensor product of the zero in ground state vectors of all the harmonic oscillators. That is to say, for each momentum 3 vector, we have a harmonic oscillator, quantum harmonic oscillator, which has a ground state. And we consider every one of these harmonic oscillators to be an independent quantum system. And we can consider the tensor product of these quantum systems, I mean, the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of these quantum systems. That's the Hilbert space of the entire quantum field theory. And the tensor product of all the ground states of the individual subsystems, all these harmonic oscillators, that tensor product is a state in the entire Hilbert space. Right? So each harmonic oscillator, so for every momentum, each harmonic oscillator has its own quantum system, its own Hilbert space, its own operators. But together, all these harmonic oscillators form a bigger quantum system that has its Hilbert space. And the zero-in vector, without any qualifications here, the zero-in vector is a vector in that entire, in the Hilbert space of the entire quantum field theory. And the zero-in k vectors are the ground states of the harmonic oscillators, one for each momentum. So the zero-in operator for the harmonic oscillator with momentum k, acting on the overall ground state, annihilates that ground state because the ground state is, in particular, an eigenvector to all an eigenvector to the A in k operator with eigenvalue 0. You see, when we write it like that, what we really mean, this is an abbreviation, what we really mean is identity operator, identity operator. It's identity, tensor, identity, tensor, identity, and afterwards also identity, tensor, identity, and so on. This operator is acting non-trivially only on one tensor factor, only on one quantum system here, namely on the k harmonic oscillator. And it acts as the identity on all the other subsystems. But of course, it would be very tedious to write lots of identities all the time. But it's good to know that in principle, they have to be there. And if we don't do an infrared cutoff, then we have a continuous momentum space, and we would need continuously infinitely many tensor products, which is mathematically hard to do. It's very ambiguous how we do a continuous infinite tensor product. Therefore, it's much better to do an infrared cutoff, preferably also with an ultraviolet cutoff, so that we have only a finite number of these tensor products. Even if it's a lot of them, it's still better to have a finite number than to have infinitely many and then run into mathematical difficulties. I will later demonstrate where these difficulties come from. I mean, why having infinitely many tensor product factors is a problem. And again, it's not quite known whether it's a fundamental problem or just a technical issue. So now, what does the Hamiltonian look like? Well, the Hamiltonian for early times doesn't have the driving force. It's the usual Hamiltonian, which is the integral over all k values and the harmonic oscillator for each one of the k values. Actually, this omega needs to have an index k, right? Because the omega depends on k. I just don't have the pencil here to fix this. Right, and then by choosing the A and A dagger operators in the way we did, we see if we go up here, by choosing the A and A dagger operators with these exact prefactors, we can arrange, just like we did for the individual harmonic oscillator, that all of these harmonic oscillators, when expressed in terms of the A and A dagger, simply become of that form, where we have the A dagger A, and no A dagger square terms, and no A square terms. Since we did not implement an infrared cutoff here, we get a Dirac delta instead of a Kronecker delta, which is a mathematical issue, and it's called an infrared divergence. But it would go away if we put the system into a large box. Yeah, you see, in the box, we would have the harmonic oscillators. It's the sum of the individual harmonic oscillators, Hamiltonian, and it has this prefactor, and here we have a 1/2. So now, what after the driving ends? After the driving ends, we define again A out operators and A dagger out operators. And we find in exactly the same way as we did it for the individual harmonic oscillator that the A out operator is the A in operator plus J naught. But now for every one of the harmonic oscillators, that is to say for every one of the modes separately. And now we get not just one J naught number, but for every harmonic oscillator, we get one of these J naughts. And what is the JK here? That's the Fourier transform of the J of X and T. Now remember that we found when we looked at the individual quantum harmonic oscillator, we found that the J naught is the Fourier coefficient of the driving force picked at the resonance frequency. So if the driving force didn't contain the resonance frequency, then the driving force was doing its job in vain. After it was done, the harmonic oscillator was back in its ground state. Now we have this J of X and its Fourier transform, JK. And now the same issue applies to all of these harmonic oscillators. But of course, now you can't avoid that you will always excite something, because the J of X will have some Fourier coefficients that are non-zero. Otherwise, there is no driving force. So if there's a driving force, it will have some Fourier coefficients that are non-zero. But all Fourier coefficients come up for some modes, right? Because you can always choose K values for which the omega is the relevant omega, which means that if you have some external driving force that in the form of a classical current, so classical charge is going about, then you're bound to excite the field in some way. So the point is that for every mode, we have again a Bogoliubov transformation. And the J naught K can be calculated by just performing this Fourier transform. And then we can calculate the overlap between the zero in vector and the out basis, as we did before. We have an explicit expression for this already. We don't have to recalculate that. And therefore, we can calculate now the probability for finding the particle, for finding the harmonic oscillator of the momentum k in the nth excited state. So for example, we might prepare the quantum field without any excitation at the beginning. So it was in the vacuum state. And then we run some charges around, and we calculate these Fourier coefficients, J naught K. And then we get the Bogoliubov transformation, and we can calculate these coefficients. And that tells us, after the charge has done its thing, how many photons of what momentum we have. For every momentum k, we can calculate this overlap, and that tells us so many photons of this momentum is what we have. And in particular, we could, for example, take an antenna and just shoot charges up and down, have a current going, if we did this for the electromagnetic field. Then we could calculate the analog of that, and that would tell us what the radiation characteristics is of this antenna. Right, so in which direction it would send the most photons. For example, not in the direction of the antenna. But the Klein-Gordon field and the electromagnetic field differ in this, by the way. If you had a Klein-Gordon antenna, it would actually radiate along the antenna, whereas the electromagnetic field radiates orthogonal to the antenna. I mean, most strongly orthogonal to the antenna. So, I think this picture we had already, this was just saying that if you had a lake, you can measure the amplitude of the waves with a cork. And you can also use the cork to make waves. And similarly here, you can use a charge, a test charge, to see how much the electric field pulls on it. So you can measure the strength of the electromagnetic field, for example, this way. Or you can use your charge, in this case, in this way, to actually make electromagnetic fields. But so far, it's been classical electromagnetic fields that do that. So now what we can do is we can give the charge its own dynamics, and we can make it quantum. So this is just a preview of what we will do next. So here we have, again, the waves on the lake. And as we said, you can use a cork to measure how it goes up and down, but you can also move the cork. You can draw it, drag it through the water, for example, to make waves. But that's not the analog of what an atom, for example, would do. The mechanical analog of what an atom does is if you take this cork and you cut it into two pieces and you put a little spring in there between the two pieces, then you could have that this harmonic oscillator, this spring, is in its ground state. There's nothing moving. But you could also have that this cork is actually, let's say, elongated or depressed. And then if you let go, it will start vibrating. And in principle, if there was no friction, it would just keep doing this. It would stay in its excited state. But if it's actually in the pond, then the pond will pick up that energy and waves will propagate. And it's a bit like that with an atom. The atom has an internal degree of freedom, just like this cork has with this spring. For the atom, it's not going to be a harmonic oscillator, but it's an internal degree of freedom. It can be excited. And so if you excite an atom, then it can quiet down, just like this cork can quiet down, and in the process release its energy by exciting the electromagnetic field. But of course, the opposite can also happen, namely that this cork is completely quiet and it's just sitting there in the water, but now a big wave comes along and will pull and tug on this thing, and then it will start oscillating. Similarly, for the atom, it might be in its ground state. But now electromagnetic waves come along, and they might excite the atom. So that's what we want to calculate, the quantum version of it, where the atom is quantum. See, so far, we worked with what is called classical light. We achieved that by using classical charges and currents in our Klein-Gordon model of it. And remember what that implied. It meant that if you create your field excitations, they're always going to be coherent. It's always going to be a coherent state. Whatever you do, it applies not only to the individual harmonic oscillator, but also to the entire quantum field. You can take charges and shake them around, make currents go up and down antennas. At the end of it, the electromagnetic field is going to be in a coherent state for each one of the harmonic oscillators. And so the electromagnetic field will appear as classical as it can be, because the uncertainty principle will be saturated. The inequality will be saturated at its equality value. But not so here. If we take an atom and have it in excited state and then goes to its ground state, we cannot describe that as a classical charge doing the one or the other thing, because an atom is not like a planetary system where you have some charge that is going around and then it decides to go another way around and you have a current between the two. That's not how this works. And so we really need to use the quantum character of the charges and the currents as well. And then we obtain light. We obtain excitations of the electromagnetic field that are not coherent states, quantum light. Of course, there are many other ways as well to get that. But not by just shaking charges. Okay, so we started with this Hamiltonian, if you remember. That was the Hamiltonian of the Klein-Gordon field with everywhere the hats except for the J. But now we want to upgrade that so that we consider the source also to be quantum. That means that the source itself must have its own Hilbert space. It must be described as a quantum system. The electron, for example, would be a quantum system. An atom is a quantum system. And that means we have now two quantum systems to deal with. The quantum system of the electromagnetic or Klein-Gordon field, which itself consists of infinitely many harmonic oscillators, one for each mode. But overall, it's just one quantum system, the quantum system of the quantum field, and the quantum system of whatever drives it externally. And that could be an atom or a molecule, or it could be a current that we describe quantum mechanically. But in any case, this has its own, this is an observable then of a quantum system. So we put a hat there and it has to act on its own Hilbert space. This is not going to act on the Hilbert space of the field. That's its own Hilbert space. So it's an observable of its quantum system. And so we have to use the tensor product here. This then is an operator which acts with this on the first subsystem's Hilbert space and with that on the second subsystem's Hilbert space. So if the first Hilbert space is that of the charges, then we have here a 1, right? Because this operator acts trivially on the atom, for example, because it's only the energy of the quantum field. And here we have the interaction Hamiltonian between the two. In principle, we should add now, or later we will, add the Hamiltonian of the atom itself. So we have a Hamiltonian of the quantum field, the interaction Hamiltonian, and the free Hamiltonian of just the atom. It's a curious thing that this works, that you can actually take a first quantized system and have it interact with a second quantized system. But that's what we're going to do. So you take the quantum field theory, which is a second quantized theory, where, for example, the positions are no longer eigenvalues to the position operator. There's no position operator per se. And then you take an atom, which you may describe in the way that you did in the first quantum mechanics class, with the Schrödinger equation, electron described by the Schrödinger equation, and so on. And then you can actually couple these. There's no problem in coupling a first quantized to a second quantized system. Just add the Hamiltonians, write down an interaction Hamiltonian. We will do that in great detail. It's quite non-trivial, though, to actually see how a first quantized system arises from a second quantized system. You see, in nature, as far as we know, everything is second quantized, including a hydrogen atom. It's just super tedious to describe a hydrogen atom quantum field theoretically. Because there you would have to describe the electron. That's not so bad, it's just a Dirac Hamiltonian. But then you would also have to describe the proton and the interaction between the two. So you would have the quantum field theory of the electron, the quantum field theory of the electromagnetic field that binds them together. And then the proton is not an elementary particle. You would have to describe the quarks that make it up and the gluons that interact between them and glue them all together, and then the electromagnetic force that acts on the whole bunch. Way too hard. And while it would be more accurate to do it this way, often our atoms might not be relativistic. And so we might get away with a non-relativistic first quantized description of it. But some of my students have written theses where this came up. So we can, if you want, I can give you some references and you can read up on how that actually goes, how you go from a second quantized description to a first quantized.
When you have, for example, the example of an atom interacting with an EM field, to get a Hamiltonian of this form, usually they interact with either some monopole or dipole moment. I'm failing to see the physical picture of how the Klein, what is the interaction between a Klein-Gordon field and an atom?
It's too early. We will see that in the next lecture. Yeah. But keep that question in mind. Maybe raise it again. Let's just finish these slides and then we can continue these questions. Okay, so what we did is we coupled the quantum system of J to the quantum system of the Klein-Gordon field. And the quantum system of the J could be a first quantized system. It could be just a hydrogen atom, for example. But it could also be a quantum field. It could be, for example, that J hat of X is a Q hat of T times the Dirac delta of X minus X tilde of T, where X tilde of T is a trajectory. We will cover these cases. Overall, we have a total Hilbert space H total, which is the tensor product of the H of the atom and the H of the field. Now, in a simplified notation, we might just write the interaction Hamiltonian as J hat of X and T times phi hat of X and T. There are many, many, many ways this can be done. And it depends on the circumstances which trade-offs to do in terms of accuracy or ease of or calculability. Okay, and then as we said, charged systems can act as emitters as well as receivers of waves. And so similarly, when we describe the interaction between an atom and the electromagnetic field, then the atom can plays a double role. It can excite the electromagnetic field, but it can also be excited by the electromagnetic field. See, to be fair to the system, we should not consider one to be primary and the other secondary. So far we did. So far we said that the quantum harmonic oscillator is externally driven, and whatever was driving it was not impacted by what the quantum harmonic oscillator did. So basically, the quantum harmonic oscillator was kind of a slave to whatever the driving force did. But that's not how nature works, right? The electromagnetic field will back react on whatever does the driving. And so what we will see is this interaction between the, let's say, the atom as an example, or molecule on one hand, and the electromagnetic field on the other hand. This study, we will do that in great detail in the next lecture on Thursday. Let me just mention that this is of interest, or it's important for two reasons. On one hand, it gives us a new interpretation for a new definition of what a particle is. So far, you've seen one definition of what a particle is, and that was a particle is an excitation of a mode oscillator. Right? A mode oscillator is the harmonic oscillator for one Fourier mode, for one k value. For each k vector, for each momentum, we have a harmonic oscillator. And if that oscillator is five times excited, it's in the fifth excited state, then we say we have five particles of this momentum. But that's a very non-local concept. And usually, the particles that we are dealing with are not entirely delocalized. But that view of what a particle is a view that is completely delocalized, right? It says, oh, we have particles of this momentum or that momentum. But if you know the momentum of a particle, you have no idea where it is. So Andrew and others De Witt and others came up with a new definition. Well, it's half a century old now, but it's a bit newer than this one, with another definition of what a particle is. And that definition is that a particle is what a particle detector detects. Sounds redundant, but it's not. It's not circular. What it means is this. You can use an atom or a molecule as a detector for what's going on in the field. It's a bit like this cork. If it's not oscillating and you just have it float there in the lake, then it can serve as a detector of possible excitations there. Because as waves pass through that cork, it's going to oscillate. And if you know nothing about the waves, but you have your eyes trained on just the spring there, you will be able to tell whether a wave passed through it or not. And similarly, for an electromagnetic field, you can put an atom in there, and even if you have no access to the electromagnetic field directly, you can observe what the atom does, whether or not it gets excited. And that tells you whether or not electromagnetic waves pass through. It's actually a bit more complicated because the atom is not a universal detector. It's not resonant with all waves. It's only resonant with waves that have the right energy gap. But apart from that limitation, an atom or a similar system such as an ion or a molecule can act as a detector of field excitations, which is also why atoms and molecules and ions are sometimes called detectors, so-called Unruh de Witt detectors, after the folks who first came up with the idea to define particles as whatever makes a particle detector excited. So we would say there was a photon of energy such and such in the field if my atom was lifted by this much energy. So the excitation of the atom is evidence that a photon was absorbed, was detected, therefore.
So it's only detecting the past existence.
Yeah, that's right. It's a destructive measurement. Yes, that's right. So to view atoms, ions, and molecules as detectors of particles is of conceptual interest for this reason. It seems redundant because in Minkowski space we could just use this definition as well. But when we work on curved space and curved space times where things are time dependent, then often Fourier transform, or generally, just doesn't apply. Because Fourier transform is not a covariant thing to do. It matters whether you first do a coordinate transformation, then a Fourier transform, or first Fourier transform, and then coordinate transformation. But to ask whether an atom that's in that space-time is being excited or not, that's independent of any human choices such as coordinate systems or Fourier transforms and so on. So on one hand, it's of conceptual interest because it's a more stable notion of particle than the one that's based on mode oscillators, especially because, as we will later see, the decomposition of a quantum field into independent harmonic oscillators is far from unique. It's super non-unique, as we will see, and only in special highly symmetric cases do we know for sure which choice of decomposition to pick. But this definition is always possible. So on one hand, it's going to be a very handy definition. But on the other hand, once we learn how to describe how atoms and molecules interact with the electromagnetic field, we know how to describe everything we see, right? Because it's a light-matter interaction. Everything we see is the interaction of matter with the electromagnetic field. And that's what we will do on Thursday, how to describe the interaction between matter and the electromagnetic field.
I think I've heard of a theory, in quantum field theory, that tells you something that measurements in quantum field theory cannot be in a finite region, can be localized in a finite region. Is this true? And if it is, how it is, how I reconcile that theorem with that, you know, particle detector detects something locally?
Yes, it's true. There are theorems that show that in quantum field theory, you cannot make a local measurement. It's one of the reasons for why there cannot be a position operator in quantum field theory. Now, here, you can see that in the approach where you define a particle as an excitation of a mode, this comes up in the following problem. We could say, well, I know how many particles I have for each wavelength, so I should be able to Fourier transform that back and then obtain a position space representation of that. And if I perform a measurement in momentum space, I can look at the Fourier transform of that. But it turns out that the Fourier transform is not covariant. You actually need an extra factor of 1 over square root of omega in order to make this thing covariant. And then what you have is that the Fourier transform would be one thing, what is covariant is another thing, and you always have this trade-off that you either have something that is looking local, but then it's not covariant, or it's covariant, but then it's non-local. And so this is the difficulty in that picture. Now, in the picture where we have a first quantized atom or molecule, the way it's resolved, or the way that it comes up, is different. It's that the idea that the atom is localized is not really true either. Right? You always have some smearing function for it. You always have that it has some support somewhere. Now, you might think, OK, I can localize my atom to a certain extent, and then not too much. I just localize it to some extent. And then if the atom gets excited, I've made a measurement of a photon. I've made a local measurement in the sense that I know for sure that the atom has detected a photon in that small finite region, in apparent contradiction to these theorems that say that you can't have a local measurements in quantum field theory. But that's not so. And the reason is that you can't really localize an atom in a region cleanly. There is a theorem in Fourier theory which says that if you have a function that has support only on a finite interval, then its Fourier transform is defined on as non-zero value on values on the entire real line. Which means that an atom that is localized, no matter how big the region, if it's completely localized, it must have momentum probability amplitudes for arbitrarily large momenta, which get out of the range of validity. Because the range of validity of such a first quantized description is the non-relativistic regime. And you know that non-relativistic quantum mechanics really, really breaks down very easily when you test it towards relativity. Take, for example, a particle that you, just in ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you want to localize it, let's say, through a single slit experiment. Wave function runs up against the wall, a single slit goes through. You might think, oh, sharp corners, right? But, and then you have a momentum distribution, but unfortunately, this is not causal. Non-relativistic quantum mechanics violates causality, because if the particle goes through that single slit, then it has a finite probability to travel faster than the speed of light when it comes out. Right? It's unavoidable. Because if you limit its support in position space, you can't limit its frequency domain. So therefore, its momentum cannot be bounded. There is always some finite momentum for arbitrarily high momentum. There's always a finite probability for arbitrarily high momentum, which is way faster than the speed of light, and that can't be so, it's not causal. So special relativity really breaks down there. So the whole model of having an unruly detector testing the electromagnetic field is good for everyday light-matter interactions. It's good for testing as a conceptual tool here, but you have to be really careful not to stretch its validity. Actually, I wrote a paper, I think 2022, with a postdoc here at PI, who is now in Switzerland, where we upgraded the unruly detector model by replacing the atom with an elementary particle that has two manifestations. Like the electron has a heavier brother, which is the muon, 200 times heavier. Other than that, it has exactly the same quantum numbers. This is similar to having an atom. An atom, when it's excited, also has more energy, right? It's also heavier. So the point is that an atom has internal energetic states. And an atom is not easily describable by second quantization. But if you have just one elementary particle that has internal excitation states, and you can think of the electron as having not just, it cannot only appear as the electron, but it also appears as the muon in the second and then as a tauon in the third generation. You can view this as a system that has energy levels, and it's an elementary particle. You don't have to describe it as a bound state of anything. And so in that case, what we try to do here is have unruh Divitt detectors that are themselves second quantized, that are described fully quantum field theoretically. You can do this, but of course there's a price to pay, which is that unlike the atom in first quantization, which has position operators, if you have unruh Divitt detectors that are themselves elementary particles that are described by second quantization, well then you have no longer any trouble with relativity. That's fine, because you're working with relativistic quantum field theory. But you can't localize them anymore, right? Because it's them, they're themselves the quantum field theory now. So if you really want to describe unruh Divitt detectors completely cleanly, then they no longer serve the purpose for which they were originally intended, namely that you can use them as local probes. Well, you can still use them then, but not any further as before. But for many circumstances, luckily, we have relativistic stuff such as photons flying around, but we test them with non-relativistic things, such as our eyes. And for that, it is good enough to work with first quantized systems that interact with the electromagnetic field. And what we will see next time, when we will develop the theory of a system such as an atom interacting with a field such as the Klein-Gordon field or the electromagnetic field, what we will find is that we can then pretty quickly determine that that the very notion of particles, which seems so stable if you think about it, what unruh and Divitt came up with, is not so stable after all. See, unruh and Divitt said, we just say that particles are what a particle detector detects. But what we will see is that if you accelerate your detector, then it might click in the sense that the atom might get excited, even if the electromagnetic field is in its vacuum state. And that gives us a hint that there's something going on with gravity too, because acceleration and gravity in certain circumstances by the equivalence principle cannot even be distinguished. And so what we will show is that acceleration can make particles, not by external driving, but by parametric excitation, actually. Yeah, okay, so that's what we will do next. The description of atoms coupled to a field, or first quantized systems coupled to a second quantized system. And then we use that to see how we can calculate the light-matter interaction, and also to test the definition of particles by giving the atom a non-trivial trajectory, and then seeing that actually it can get excited even in the vacuum state. And in this way, we will find what is called acceleration radiation, or the unruh effect. And towards the end of the course, we will revisit that. When we study the Hawking radiation, we will rederive the unruh radiation, but we will study the unruh radiation then no longer with the atoms coupled to the electromagnetic field, but we will study the unruh radiation using Bogoliubov transformations. And we will see that the unruh effect that is to say, particle creation because of acceleration doesn't hinge on this definition. It arises also if you define, if you calculate things differently. It's a stable effect. It hasn't been measured yet. Under effect hasn't been measured yet, but hopefully it will be measured soon. That would be very cool because it's the acceleration analog of what in the gravity version is the Hawking effect. Right? You just replace the gravity of a black hole by the acceleration. I wrote with some colleagues a paper on how to make the Andrew effect more observable. So the Andrew effect is extremely hard to measure because the amount of acceleration that would be needed to make the Andrew radiation measurable is just outlandishly large. The LHC is not nearly powerful enough to accelerate particles to that extent. But what we found is that there is a way to stimulate the Andrew effect. Namely, roughly speaking, you illuminate the experiment with laser, with a laser beam, and that will make the Andrew effect much, much more likely to occur. And, well, there are some experimental efforts on the way. We'll see.